ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नमो विष्णुपादाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी इति नामिने। नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे रामा राम रामा हरे हरे, हरे कृष्णा। Has the translation and purport been read already?
Yes, Prabhu, we read them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hare Krishna.
So this is in the section of the Bhagavatam where a lot of prayers and a lot of cosmological description is being given. The intent, the focus of the Bhagavatam is being revealed. In some ways, the flow of the Bhagavatam is not like an arrow. No, arrow just moves straight. The flow of the Bhagavatam is more like a spiral. A spiral seems to be moving round and round and round. But while moving round and round and round, it is moving in a particular direction. And eventually, it hits that target. So like that, the Bhagavatam, in what sense is it like a spiral? It seems to address many different issues. It addresses cosmology, it addresses genealogy, it addresses psychology. But while addressing all these things, cosmology is the fifth canto, genealogy is the whole, the manvantaras and all the various lists of dynasties are there. Psychology is especially with respect to the analysis of the modes and the gunas with the third canto, many other places also. So it is doing all this analysis. So each of these is like a spiral. So while it is doing a spiral, the focus is clear. Somebody just looks at, okay, this moving round and round and round. Okay, what's going on? But while going around, it is going in a particular direction. So even while having the discussion about cosmology, the Bhagavatam's focus is on spirituality, on bhakti spirituality. That's why within the description of the cosmos, there are such beautiful prayers. And this prayer is talking about the universality of bhakti. Suro asuro vapyata vanaro naraha Sarvatmanaya sukrutagyam uttamam agyam uttamam bhajeta ramam manujakritim harim ya uttaran anayat kosalan divamiti. So it is describing that sura asuro vapi athavanaro naraha, that whether it is devatas or the danavas, or even if it is not even human beings, the vanaras are there, everybody can actually practice bhakti. Bhajeta ramam, they can worship Lord Ram. Lord Ram was so inclusive. So he talks about, we have among the asuras, we have Vibhishan became his devotee. Vanaras, of course, we have. The Vanara, he had entire Vanara army. There were, of course, bears also. There were even outcasts like we had Shabari, who was considered to be relatively lowborn. She was his devotee. So everybody was included within it. And then there is said to be the fisherman who offered Lord Ram fish, but Lord Ram embraced him and accepted his love, even if not a specific offering. So the universality of bhakti is being discussed over here in this particular verse. So that is the theme I will focus on today in our discussion. How the bhakti tradition fosters universal equality. And within this broad theme, we'll discuss this verse and three topics I'll discuss: the journey from philosophical equality to historical equality. And the second point we'll discuss is, did the bhakti tradition create a hierarchy of its own? And third is, in today's world, there are different perspectives. How can we balance those? So let's look at the first part. So with respect to Indian traditions, there is something which is both an irony and a tragedy. Now, irony refers to something which is sadly, which is opposite to how it should be. So if somebody brilliant speaks something foolish, then that's an irony. If a country which has the best, both best weaponry gets very easily defeated, that's an irony. So irony means something opposite to what is expected. Now, irony can be humorous, but if the irony is saddening, it's devastating, then it's a tragedy. So with respect to the Indian tradition, there is this irony which has turned out to be which is also a tragedy. What is that? Among the various traditions in the world, theistic or non-theistic, no other tradition has emphasized the philosophical equality of all living beings as clearly as the broad Vedantic tradition. So where we say that, you know, that all of us are parts of that one spiritual reality. Before Christianity, or even within Christianity, which is the main religious system, there were people who thought that women had no souls. There are people who even now think that animals don't have souls, or at least they don't have the kind of souls that we think that humans have. So that kind of differentiation was very much there. But within the Vedic tradition, there is a very clear emphasis that equality and oneness of all living beings. And it's that all of us essentially are spiritual beings. In that sense, everyone is equal. Even the souls of non-human beings are also equal. But it's ironical that although there was philosophical equality, there was actually historical inequality. What do you mean by historical inequality? What I mean is that, actually speaking, there was a very serious discrimination that resulted. No other tradition in the world had such a strong, rigid, religiously mandated and enforced hierarchy that soon became discriminatory and exploitative. So what do I mean by this? That, yes, there always been discrimination and hierarchy has always been there. So, for example, if you look at the European history, there was a very rigid hierarchy. There were the nobility, the clergy and the nobility were there. Then there were the common people, the serfs. And there would be no intermarriage between the people who were from they didn't use the word caste, they used the word higher classes. So that was there. But that was more functional or socio-economic. Whereas in the Vedic tradition, this was considered to be like a religious hierarchy. This is like when Krishna says Varnashram, I have created Varnashram. Maya Srishtam. So now, of course, we know that there is a difference between Varnashram and the caste system. But the point is that there was this big disconnect that philosophically no other tradition emphasized equality and oneness of all living beings as much as the Vedic tradition. Practically, in terms of history, while there was equality everywhere, a religiously mandated inequality. That means, if somebody is a lower caste, why are they lower caste? There is a philosophical justification for that. You know, that because you have done bad activity in the past, that's why you are over here, and that's why just stay satisfied over there. So now, traditionally, Varnashram was simply a division of labor according to socio-economic purposes, that everybody works according to their own nature and contributes to society. But soon after that, it became corrupted. It became, as we know, based on birth, and birthright made it wrong. So this disconnect, lofty philosophy and very tragic inequality, how are these to be reconciled? So why is this disconnect, this disparity? There is often a saying that power corrupts. But that's one aspect of it. Power doesn't just corrupt. Power also reveals the corrupt. What is the difference between these two things? That means somebody is originally a pure-hearted person. But when they get power, that power corrupts. That means when they have power, there's a tendency to abuse that power for their personal purposes. So somebody who is, say, for example, somebody becomes a powerful, say, head of state. So does it that after becoming the head of state, that person becomes corrupt? Or is it that is one possibility, but another possibility also is that power reveals the corrupt. That means that person always had the tendency to abuse state resources for personal purposes, but they didn't have access to the state resources. And once they got access to those state resources, then their corruption became revealed to the world. So both are possible. Power can corrupt, and power can reveal who is already corrupt in their hearts. Then they become power and make sure the corrupt, they become corrupt in their deeds also. It becomes evident in their deeds. So what is the context over here? That in the Vedic tradition, those who were meant to teach philosophical equality, they neglected the aspect of philosophical equality and they focused more on teaching the caste hierarchy. That rather than telling that those people who are Shudras or Vaishyas or Lechas and Yavanas, that you are also spiritual beings, you are also parts of God. So that was neglected. And what they focus on is, you are lower caste, you are meant to serve us. So that was their self-interest that came up. Now this was Srila Prabhupada's distinctive vision, that when you enter the West, or when now naturally, even from Western standards, the hippies and the members of the counterculture were often having habits that were questionable, if not reprehensible. But Srila Prabhupada focused not on so much on their behavior, but on their potential. He saw the spark of spiritual interest. So that is a choice which, going back to the previous slide now, it is a choice of the teachers. What they do, they in their teaching, do they focus on the equality of all living beings, or do they focus on the inequality that is there at a functional level? So Prabhupada focused on the equality, and that was his distinctiveness. That's what gave him his ability to touch people's hearts. If we are looking down at people, then even if we are kind and compassionate, that order of condescension comes out. We are looking down on people and nobody likes to be looked down upon. So within such a social context, where unfortunately the equality had been downplayed, and the inequality had been overemphasized, the bhakti tradition emerged. And now bhakti is a teaching of the Vedic texts. It's one of a conclusive teaching of the Vedic texts, Vedaishcha Sarvair Ahameva Vedyo. However, it has not always been equally emphasized throughout human history, even from the perspective of Vedic history. That's why even when the Bhagavatam is being recited, at that time in the Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami is telling Parikshit Maharaj that Muktanam api Siddhanam, that even among Muktas and Siddhas, those who are Vasudeva Parayana, those who are Narayana Parayana, Sudurlabha Prashantatma Kotishwapi Mahamune. So these are very, very rare people. So even in the Bhagavatam, when the time of the, speaking of the Bhagavatam, there were many sages. So there was an overall strong spiritual culture. But even at that time, the sages were confused when Parikshit Maharaj wanted to know what is the best thing to do at the time of death. Because at that time, there were many different philosophies. And all these different philosophies and their proponents, they were thinking, what is the best thing to do? They championed their philosophy, but they also had their reservations. Is this the best thing for this king to do at this moment? So the point I'm making is, while bhakti as a teaching within the scriptures is a eternal and conclusive teaching, it was not widely known or widely accessible. So this happened largely in the medieval times, from the time of Ramanujacharya onwards, the bhakti teaching started getting systematized and spread widely. So one reason why I chose this angle for this topic is also Recently, in the Sri Sampradaya, they made a magnificent statue of Ramanujacharya, and they call it the Temple of Equality, the Statue of Equality. That Ramanujacharya was a pioneer of bringing equality within the disparity that was there within the Indian setting at that time. That is also one of the reasons why Buddhism and Jainism spread widely, because people who were disenfranchised by the lower castes, people who were by the castes, people who were belonging to the lower castes, they felt that we are being discriminated here, better let us leave and go to some other religion where we won't have the discrimination. However, it is not so easily resolved, because what happened is that these hierarchies, they were so ingrained within the mind that even today, sometimes Hindus convert to Christianity or Islam. But even within Christianity and Islam, there is this consciousness, oh, actually, I have a higher birth. Because it's more of a mentality that has not so much to do with the religion or the religious beliefs of people. It is more a cultural conditioning or a social conditioning that has happened for many generations. And simply changing one's religion doesn't change that. So, but what did the Bhakti tradition do? It offers equal spiritual opportunity to everyone. And everyone means not just all human beings, but all living beings. That's why Vanara Nara, it is mentioned over here. We have the famous verse, Mami Partha Vyapashitya, Yepisyu Papa Yonaya, Striyo Vaishya Dhashudras, Tepi Yanti Paramgatim. So, now, Papa Yonaya, sometimes that is used as a describer for Striya Vaishya Shudra, but there are acharyas who also use Papa Yonaya as a separate category. And Prabhupada also says Papa Yonaya in several of his lectures. Prabhupada uses Papa Yonaya as a separate category. And Papa Yonaya can refer to Lekchas Yavanas, but Vedanta Deshika, who is a prominent commentator in the Sri Vaishnava tradition following Ramanujacharya, the two prominent followers of Ramanujacharya, from whom two major groups of Sri Vaishnavism came about. So one of them is Pillailokacharya, the other is Vedanta Deshika. So Vedanta Deshika, in his commentary to this verse 932, he says that Papa Yonaya refers even to animals. And he quotes Puranic stories and stories from Ramanujacharya's life of how even a fish who got some water when Ramanujacharya finished his prasad, and then he was washing his hands, and the water fell from his hand, that touched his hands, was drunk by a fish, and that fish got a celestial body, got a Vishnumurti, Chaturbhuja form, and got liberated. So he used stories like that, and we may call them Loka Praman, they may not be Shastra Praman, but still he used stories like that to say that bhakti actually includes, bhakti can engage and elevate everyone. So that Papa Yonaya, it can include all living beings, and not just human, but even non-human beings. So Krishna says, not only can everybody practice bhakti, tepi yanti paramgatim. Paramgatim is a supreme destination, not just some little elevation, the supreme destination. So that is the glory of the bhakti tradition. So from this, so from philosophical equality to historical equality, how did it come about? That was brought about by the bhakti tradition. Without the bhakti tradition, this journey wouldn't have happened. Unfortunately, the historical inequality would have remained. So now, in India, there's always a lot of leftist media, which keeps finding faults with everything about the Indian tradition. So when Ramanujacharya, this Statue of Equality was inaugurated, several prominent Indian heads of state and other leaders were present for that inauguration. So some newspapers, they said, actually, you know, this is over-glorification. There's no historical evidence for this. They said that, okay, you may say Ramanujacharya talked about equality, but in the places in the world where there is, in the places or parts of India where there is, where Ramanujacharya's followers are there, Vishnu Vaishnavism is there, the caste system is still present. So, is it that the number of people in the lower caste has decreased? Are the Brahmanas no longer there and other Brahmanas no longer have influence? They still have. So, how was this equality actually brought about? So, now, So what exactly did the bhakti tradition do? So their argument is, okay, there was a caste hierarchy and bhakti tradition creates its own hierarchy. What is the hierarchy? That I am a bhakta, so I am pure, and anybody who is not a bhakta, you are impure. So I am special, and anybody who is not a devotee, they are terrible people. So did the bhakti tradition simply replace one hierarchy with another hierarchy? Did it actually create equality or just another form of inequality? Because it can happen that as devotees, we may start thinking, oh, I'm a devotee, so I'm superior to all these non-devotees. Actually, bhakti should bring humility, not arrogance. So did it create a hierarchy of its own? Let's try to understand this. So did bhakti eradicate caste system? Not exactly. Because generally, to eradicate a social system, that requires political power. Because if some structure is existing in society, so how do we remove that structure? It is already there. So it requires, one aspect that is required is political power. So for example, when now with the war going on between Ukraine and or Russia attacking Ukraine, a lot of people are trying to understand the situation of Russia and how USSR broke apart. One of the most momentous events of the last century. And when communism disintegrated, so communism was already dysfunctional. And people were living in abject poverty and great misery. There were great man-made famines caused in Ukraine because of the mismanagement of the by the government. So situations were terrible. But it was only when the political system changed that you could say the communism was removed. And then there is some kind of capitalistic, socialistic hybrid that is there. In China, sorry, Russia has some kind of capitalist, or you could say oligarchy, and oligarchy is a group of influential people ruling. Oligarchic and commun capitalistic hybrid is there. China has more like a autocratic capitalistic hybrid is there. But whatever it is, but the point is that to if there are deeply ingrained social systems, to remove them requires political power. And in general, the bhakti tradition didn't focus too much on gaining political power. Bhakti tradition focused on transforming people's hearts. That's why, even when we see that Mahaprabhu, he was not very eager to meet Pratap Rudra. And even when he met Pratap Rudra, he did not tell Pratap Rudra, okay, now spread Vaishnavism everywhere. That use all your state resources to make everybody chant Hare Krishna. Anybody who doesn't fast on Ekadashi, put them into jail. Nothing like that. That was not a part of the tradition at all, because bhakti is something which is voluntary. Faith cannot be legislated or mandated. And faith is actually preliminary to devotion. Faith is just Shraddha. Yes, God exists and God is good. Devotion is actually much greater. Devotion is, I love God. Like in our ninefold stage of bhakti, there is Shraddha. And from Shraddha, we go onward towards the various stages of, we have Ruchi, and then Asakti, and then we have Bhava, Prema. So even faith cannot be legislated. Even if you tell somebody, you believe in God, or I'll shoot you. That person may say, I believe in God. But the threat may make the person speak the words, but a threat cannot force the person to actually believe in God. So it's a voluntary turning of the heart towards the Lord. So the bhakti tradition recognizes that bhakti has to be inspired. And that's why it did not focus too much on gaining political power. And that's why some people feel very, sometimes people feel that, why was Bhaktisaraswati Thakur so dismissive about the independence struggle? When Prabhupada was a follower of Gandhiji, and he said, oh, this will keep happening. So it is not that the independence is not important, but in the hierarchy of importance, generally the bhakti tradition has not focused so much on gaining political power. That doesn't mean it's not important, but within the various levels of what are important, that was not considered very important. That's why the bhakti tradition, it is true that just because bhakti was very widespread, that does not mean the caste system was eliminated. That even in Mahaprabhu's times and the post-Mahaprabhu times, whether you take Orissa or Bengal, the caste system still remained. People who were from lower castes were still identified as people from lower castes. So it was not so much the eradication of the caste system, but what did the bhakti tradition do? It provided a liberating pathway. What is the pathway? It created a pathway for both social and spiritual elevation. For those who were discriminated against by the caste system. That means, if we consider Haridas Thakur, was lowborn, not only lower caste, you could say he's an outcast. And he, because of his great devotion, he was respected. And it is not just spiritually respected, it's socially respected. Socially respected, spiritually respected means that, okay, yeah, he's a great devotee. But socially respected means on social occasions, how is that person treated? So we see that when Advaita Acharya was there for his father, he offered the first, offered the prasad first to Haridas Thakur. So he socially was respected. And just two generations after Mahaprabhu, when Narottam Das Thakur started his missionary work, Narottam Das Thakur was actually from a lower caste. But he was initiating those born in Brahmana families. And that was a dramatic transformation. So what happened was, yes, there were some people who identified as lower caste, some people who identified as upper castes. But what the bhakti tradition did is, yes, you may, whatever caste you may be from, if you are a devotee, then you are respectable. Not only respectable, we could say, if somebody is a great devotee, then they are venerable, they are worshipable. So that was the pathway that the bhakti tradition provided. Now, doesn't that create a hierarchy? That means, oh, if you are a lower caste and you are not a devotee, then still you are going to be discriminated against. But if you are a lower caste and you are a devotee, then you are not, you have respect. So this is just replacing caste hierarchy with bhakti hierarchy. Well, yes and no. See, not all hierarchies are born equal. See, hierarchy itself is not the problem. See, hierarchy based on factors that we have no control over. That is the problem. What do I mean? That, see, in the world, hierarchy is unavoidable. Say, if we look at physical appearance, some people will be tall, some people will be short. Some people will have a fair complexion, some people will have a not so fair complexion. Some people will have high IQ, some people will have not so high IQs. So we can't avoid hierarchy. But if a person is lifelong defined by something that is not there in their control at all and reduced to that, that is where the problem comes up. So if we consider in the West, especially in America, but in other parts of the West also, racial justice is a big slogan. So racial discrimination is talked about and that is abhorred, that is to be condemned and that is to be ended. Now, what is the problem with racial discrimination? Is a person, at least from this life's perspective, has no control over the color of their skin. Therefore, Martin Luther King said, I long for a day when in America people will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. By the content of their character. So racial discrimination means you don't look at the character, don't look at the caliber of the person. Oh, yes, you are black, therefore you are condemned. That may happen also, not just black, you are brown, that's why you are condemned. So that is racial discrimination. So if India has a cricket team, now obviously out of millions of people who are going to play cricket, 11 people are going to play for the Indian team. So there is going to be selection and those who get the national cap, they become elite people. That's a hierarchy. But that hierarchy is based on performance. That hierarchy is not based, if that hierarchy is based on, okay, these 11 people will only be from these 11 cities, say Mumbai, Delhi, Chennai, these places, and nobody else from any other part of the country will be allowed to join the Indian national team. That would be discriminatory. Where a person is born is not in their control. So, but a person can practice and perform, and if they excel, then they are included. So, when the hierarchy is based on factors that we can't control, like one's caste, one can't control. That is a problem. So, bhakti is a form of what we can call as spiritual meritocracy. Now, what is a meritocracy? Kracy means basically like autocracy, democracy we have, like a system. So, democracy is a system of governance by the people. Meritocracy is the system of social organization based on merit. So, for example, if we consider sports, ideally speaking, sports should be a meritocracy. That means the best players, best cricketers in India should make it to the Indian team. And if the best players in India happen to be from, or a significant number of the best players happen to be from a particular part of India, well, that is not discriminatory necessarily. If they are really good players, then they deserve to be in the team. So, modern Western society, it claims to be meritocracy. That means a person can come from any part of the world to America, and if they work hard, if they are intelligent, then they can make it big. They can fulfill the great American dream. Now, is that really true? Well, maybe, maybe not. Because, say, if somebody is born to parents who have gone to Ivy League colleges, and that person gets very good education, they are in a neighborhood where they can go to very good schools, and for that person, they may have the same level of IQ as a child who is born to parents who were maybe drug abusers, and that person goes to a relatively poor school, doesn't get much facilities for studying. And although that student may have a higher IQ than this other student, but it will be very difficult for that student to actually get into an Ivy League university. So whether it is actually a meritocracy is still open to question. At least that attempt is there. So bhakti hierarchy is actually a meritocracy. Why? It is that each of us has the capacity to develop devotion. So just because somebody is born in lower caste doesn't mean that they will automatically have or not have devotion. And similarly, just because somebody is born in a higher caste doesn't mean that they will have or not have devotion. It depends on individual choice. Now, of course, we may say that there is a previous life also matters. Somebody may practice bhakti in their previous life and they're continuing this life. Yes, there is a multi-life continuity. And that's why some people may have a head start over others in their spiritual journey. But nobody is left out. Everybody can practice bhakti. So in that sense, even with the bhakti tradition, so what is the equality over here? Equality is not the elimination of hierarchy. If you try to eliminate hierarchy, nobody will be able to function in life. Imagine if we all board into an airplane and we say, no hierarchy. So, now why should that person be the pilot? Why should that person be making the announcements? Why should this particular cabin crew be giving instructions? Anybody from the passengers can go and drive the flight. Anybody can make announcements. Anybody can control the switches of the airplane. There'll be chaos. So we need to have hierarchy. But what is the hierarchy based on? That is the important thing. So bhakti allows everyone to be included. How? Because the qualification within bhakti is possible for everyone. Everybody can strive to become an advanced devotee. And everybody has the potential for practicing bhakti. And through the practice of bhakti, everybody can grow spiritually. So in that sense, it's a spiritual meritocracy. So the bhakti tradition, its equality was manifested by giving everyone the opportunity to grow spiritually. That is what Ramanujacharya did in the especially southern part of India. That is what Srila Prabhupada did all over the world. Prabhupada went to whichever part of the world, he said, all of you have the potential to love God, to love Krishna. When Prabhupada was in Africa, he was asked by a journalist, Swamiji, what is your message for Africa? And Prabhupada said that my message for Africa is the same as my message for the whole world. And that is that you have forgotten God. Without loving God, you can never be happy. So that means it was universal. So how do we function in today's world? If you understand that, bhakti provides a pathway for everyone to get elevated. So it's like there will be hierarchy. There will be hierarchy, say this is an Ivy League university, this is maybe a level 2 university, this is a level 3 university. But the point is, if all students are given opportunity to get to Ivy League universities, then it's not discriminatory. If some students are told, because you belong to this group, you'll never be allowed in this, then that is discriminatory. But the fact that there are different levels of universities, that itself is not discriminatory. So yes, the caste system remained. But irrespective of which caste a person belonged to, the bhakti tradition gave an opportunity for everyone to become socially respectable and spiritually advanced. So what does this mean in today's world? Today's world, what is the contemporary scenario? If somebody claims absolute spiritual equality, irrespective of material factors. So for example, if somebody says, men and women are absolutely equal. Well, that is just not real. Biologically, they are different. There is there should not be discrimination against any gender where they are not allowed to do certain things because of just the gender. But biologically, they are different. So there is the transgender phenomena that is becoming widespread, or at least is being widely propagated, if not widespread. So what has happened is, there are men who claim to be transgender and they claim to be women. They might do some surgery, take some hormones. And there are men who are entering, who claim to be women, and they enter into women's sports. And there are these transgender men in women's sports, they are just breaking all records and winning competitions. So these women, so for example, it's happened in swimming, it's happened in athletics. The male body is actually different from the female body, biologically speaking. So it's unfair to all those women who train maybe for decades to try to excel in a sport, and somebody with biological superiority comes in and just makes all their hard work just irrelevant, inconsequential. It's so unfair for them. So you cannot claim absolute spiritual equality. At least in athletics or swimming, there is no physical damage, although there's great damage to morale. Once transgender athletes start coming in fields like boxing, a male boxer in female boxing could be actually could be devastating in terms of physical injuries that they would cause. So we can't claim absolute spiritual equality. At the same time, we can't treat material factors as unchangeably decisive in determining spiritual opportunities. So, for example, there were many traditional Vaishnavas also within sometimes the Gaudiya tradition and other traditions who said, yes, Lechadari Yavanas can become devotees, but they cannot become Brahmanas. They cannot become Gurus. That was their reasoning. And Prabhupada said, no. Prabhupada quoted, Kiba Vipra Kiva Nasi. Shudra kena nai, yehi Krishna tattva vetta sehi guru hai. So, if somebody has devoted their life to serving Krishna and somebody has got realizations of Krishna, why can't they be a teacher? So, some people might treat the material factors, this, you are born in the Mlechcha family, therefore, this spiritual opportunity will never be available for you. That is also another extreme. So, what is the balanced understanding is that, the point of the world is not simply equality. The point is spirituality. Now, we can never have absolute equality in the world. What we can have is all of us can have spiritual opportunity. And if we grow spiritually, that is when we will gain happiness. But there is a great overemphasis on equality in today's world. Yes, equality is important. But imagine we are playing a cricket, we were watching a cricket match, and all players are equal. That means every batsman who comes is bat in the same way. Every bowler balls in the same way. Every fielder catches in the same way. All players are equal. Well, where would be the fun in watching the sports? So equality is not the ultimate purpose of life. It's an important value to be sought. But the focus has to be on spiritual growth. How can everybody be facilitated in their spiritual journey? And then, with that focus on spirituality, we analyze material factors according to how they serve that spiritual purpose. So, somebody with a particular background may be able to do a particular role better. So, if somebody has been born in a traditional Indian family where they learn Sanskrit from their birth, if they are to become a Sanskrit teacher, it may be relatively easier for them. Now, does that mean that somebody who had never heard of Sanskrit till the age of 25 when they were introduced to the Bhakti tradition, they can't become Sanskrit scholar? No, they can. Even they can, but it will be difficult for them. So do they need to do that? Is that the most important service they can do? Not necessarily. If they are personally inspired, they can do that. But if they are more equipped, more oriented to do other services, then those services are also important. So the point is, instead of trying to mandate equality, we focus on spirituality. And from everywhere, from whichever position they are, we give them an opportunity to grow spiritually. That was Srila Prabhupada's genius. Now, Srila Prabhupada, how did he equally encourage everyone? There are pastimes like this where Prabhupada would go to a farm project and he said, there's nothing more important than this farm project. It is the future of the world when the planet's ecology crumbles. And Prabhupada would go to a Gurukul project and he would say, there is nothing more important than training our children. They are the future of our movement. When he would meet book distributors, he would tell, there is nothing more important than distributing books. Because through these, people will come to Krishna. So Prabhupada, in that sense, encouraged everyone to serve Krishna. So when he was in India, Prabhupada would say to Indians that, you are from India. This message of the Bhagavad Gita is from India. So to share this message all over the world, why do I need to get people from America and rest of the world? Why can't Indians take it up? This is your message. This is your tradition. Take it up and spread it all over the world. So Prabhupada engaged Indians. When he was talking with the American disciples, he would say, you Americans are known all over the world for doing extraordinary things. So now, do something extraordinary for Krishna. Do something wonderful for Krishna. So what was Prabhupada doing? Prabhupada's focus was on elevating everyone spiritually and engaging them accordingly. So the material difference between Indians and Americans, it is there. But Prabhupada did not deny that difference. Prabhupada did not overemphasize that difference. Prabhupada said, yes, whatever be your particular background, whatever be the material factor that characterize you, see how they can be used in Krishna's service and move forward. So that is the equality of bhakti. Not elimination of all hierarchy, but equal opportunity for everyone to grow from whatever position they are in their social, cultural, national, regional structure that they are in. That is, Krishna's message, Krishna's embrace of love extends to include all living beings. And the bhakti tradition actually reveals that Krishna's loving embrace and provides everyone an opportunity to come inside Krishna's embrace and experience his eternal and eternally ecstatic love. So I'll summarize what I discussed today. I discussed how the bhakti tradition offers universal spiritual equality. And in that, we discussed 3 points. First was that how, through the bhakti tradition, the philosophical equality was translated into historical equality. So it's ironic and tragic that within the Indian tradition, although bhakti was considered very important, although philosophical equality was taught that all living beings are one, not just all human beings, but unfortunately, a rigid discriminatory system of caste was mandated and enforced. So, why did this happen? Because power corrupts and power also reveals who are corrupt. So, some people from the higher caste started misusing the caste system. And then, what did the bhakti tradition do? It opened a pathway for everyone to become spiritually elevated, irrespective of their caste designations. So then the question may come, is this really equality? Because is it not another hierarchy of those who are bhaktas and those who are not bhaktas? Well, yes, the point is not to remove hierarchy, because in the world, to function, some hierarchies are required. But what is the basis of the hierarchy? So if it is based on merit, then that hierarchy is good. If the person who is driving the plane is actually knows how to drive the plane, then it's far better that that person drive the plane than somebody who doesn't know how to drive a plane. So what bhakti is? Spiritual autocracy. When a hierarchy is based on factors that are not in our control, like somebody's race or somebody's caste, then it is that hierarchy can be discriminatory. But when the hierarchy is based on factors that we can work on, that we can improve, then that hierarchy is inclusive. It is progressive. So the bhakti tradition of, in the bhakti tradition, everybody has the potential for bhakti. That's what is the teaching of the bhakti tradition. And so everybody in that sense can go up and become socially and spiritually elevated. So that's what the bhakti tradition did. Ramanujacharya did. That's what Mahaprabhu and his followers did. That's what Srila Prabhupada did. So in today's world, how can we balance things? So we discussed the pendulum at the last. We can't claim absolute spiritual equality. Although, yes, we are souls, but we are in different kinds of bodies. And those bodily differences need to be acknowledged. But we can't let those bodily differences define us. So say that because of this, you cannot do particular things. No, before, rather than just contesting whether I can do this or I can't do this, focus on the spiritual purpose. The purpose of life is not simply to bring equality in society. The purpose of life is to elevate everyone's spirituality. And with that purpose in mind, depending on material factors, whatever material factors can be best used to promote everyone's spiritual growth, those can be accommodated. And that's how everyone can enter into Krishna's loving embrace. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any reflections or questions?
Thank you so much for such an enlightening class, Prabhu. We're talking about equality and inequality and purpose of life and the material factors that influence to actually bring closer to our purpose of life and so that we can get Krishna's prema and love. Thank you so much, Prabhu. I see some raised hands, Prabhu. So Antaranga Seva Mataji has a raised hand. Mataji, please go ahead and ask your question, Mataji, or share your reflections. Thank you.
Yeah. Hare Krishna, Prabhu, Dandavat Pranam. Thank you for the wonderful class. You were mentioning about Varnashram Dharma, the caste system, but isn't it not necessary for the society, like unless we are all devotees? Prabhupada also said, and in Gita or Krishna also says that this caste system, the four Varnas are being given by me. So why are we saying that this caste system is not necessary? Because without the caste system, it is that how the society collapses, we are seeing. The Brahmanas are needed for leading the society.
Okay. So now, this is a big subject. I understand your question. It's a huge subject. Am I saying that when we say the caste system is not necessary? See, there are multiple levels at which we can understand this. See, at a functional level, in every society, there will be some people who will be politicians, defense personnel, and some people will be intellectuals. So these kind of divisions are there in every society. So even in today's world, there are people who are political leaders, there are people who are military leaders. So broadly speaking, we could say they are doing Kshatriya roles. And there are intellectuals, there are corporate businessmen, corporate people, business people. So in one sense, in any functioning society, there will be these categories of people who are required for functioning society. So that is just a fact of life. So when Krishna says that I have created Varnashram, what he essentially means is that this kind of social division is essential for functioning in life. It's like Krishna says, you know, I have created the sun and the moon, and they give light and the earth, and I'm with the digestive system. I manage the digestive system by which you digest food. So these are essential for functioning. So whether somebody uses the name Varnashram or caste system or not, now that doesn't matter. So today's political leaders may not call themselves Kshatriyas, So functionally, this division is there. Now, there are three other factors to be considered. The second factor is that what was wrong with the caste system was that the social division was based not on functional competence, but simply on birth. That means somebody may not have any Brahminical inclination. Somebody may not actually even seek spiritual growth or study of scriptures, but they just do some rituals because that's their way to earn money. So that is the problem. Like suppose somebody is a professor in a college and they're on tenure and their child automatically becomes a professor. And they are a physics professor now, but the child didn't even pass college physics. And they are in high school physics. That will be a problem. So the question was, the caste system was problematic because it was not based on functional competence. It was based simply on genealogy. That's the second point. The third point to consider is that in today's world, how are we going to define who should go to which group? So because what has happened is today the Varanas also have become quite diverse or diversified or complexified. So for example, the idea is that if a particular person is doing a particular role, say like some devotees have very simplistic understanding. Doctors, they are Vaidyas and they are Brahmanas. Surgeons, they deal with the body, so they are Shudras. Well, I mean, I find that oversimplified because practically speaking, a surgeon has to get much more training, have much more knowledge, much more expertise than a doctor and a physician. So is it that additional training makes the Brahmana into a Vaishya? No, yeah, they deal with the body, but even doctors are dealing with the body. So it's like taking one factor alone and making it absolute. That is knowledge in the mode of ignorance. So, or for that matter, some devotee. So suppose a surgeon, maybe their hand gets damaged. Maybe their hand gets cut in an accident. And they can no longer do surgery, but they can still practice medicine. They can still be a physician. That means, are we saying that because of a physical incapacitation, a Shudra became a Brahmana? So, no, like somebody would say, scientists are Brahmanas, but engineers are Shudras. Well, really, are science and engineering that rigidly divided? No, a scientist may also do engineering work, and an engineer may also do scientific research. So suppose somebody is working in engineering, and they decide to go into a field where they're doing more research and they're doing more scientific work. So does the Varna change at that time? So the point I'm making is, how do we translate traditional categories into today's professions? It is complicated. So the fourth point I'll make is that, so rather than trying to label today's professions in terms of traditional categories, we can focus more on the underlying principle. The principle is that everybody has a particular swabhava. That means we all have particular natures. We all are naturally attracted to certain things. So, say, an intellectual is naturally attracted to books. Kshatriya, that is a Brahmana, is naturally attracted towards books. Somebody with a Brahminical inclination is naturally attracted to study, analysis of ideas, and presenting things like that. A Kshatriya is a person who has a Kshatriya tendency, naturally attracted to leadership, to taking charge of things, to making sure that things are done in an orderly way. So all of us can learn to introspect and encourage others to introspect, to try to understand what our innate interests are. And then try to find social roles, occupations that are in harmony with that particular nature, that particular innate interest. So that will be a way in which the original purpose of Varanashram can be fulfilled. Now, can we divide society into four Varanas today? Well, Prabhupada said that was 50% of his work. But how exactly are we going to do it? Prabhupada gave purposes. Yes, this is what a Brahmana should be trained to be a sense control, to be this, to be that. But how exactly are we going to do that? In our Gurukuls, we tried it, and I have met many devotees who were misdiagnosed by their teachers. Like somebody was of a Vaishya mentality and was told, a small boy, you are actually a Brahmana mentality. You are a Brahmana. And I talked with these young devotees, and they said, my childhood was like a torment. Spent hours doing pujas and doing memorizing shlokas. So, and they felt that just didn't work. So the point is, rather than focusing on recreating that social system, that can also be done. But that can be done in a small place. Maybe a particular leader with great spiritual expertise can do it in a small community, maybe a small village or a small farm community. And if that works, then that model can be replicated at a broader level. But at a generic level, we can focus on trying to understand ourselves better and then try to engage in society according to the corresponding roles. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Prabhuji, for the very beautiful answer and very, very wonderful class, Prabhuji. So, Prabhu, I have a question. In Canto 3, there is said that women cannot read Vedas, means they sing the mantras from Vedas. So, why it is like that? So, what makes the difference, like when women chants the mantra, not the male? Like?
You know, maybe we can have a separate class on this topic. later, because it's a big subject. This is where, to some extent, this is like an unresolved tension within our within our movement. You know, which is to be given higher priority, bhakti or varnashram? So it is traditionally understood within the varnashram context that we all are born with particular natures, and we could go into the specifics of those natures. But it is understood that because of the psychology and physiology associated with particular bodies, each body is more suited for particular things and less suited for particular things. So now how, I don't want to at this stage go into specifics of, you know, mantra chanting, but that is a broad principle. Now, does that principle take precedence over bhakti, or does it not take precedence over bhakti? So that is a big question, and I think that is a issue which our movement has not yet resolved. So the tension between, in certain cases, especially with respect to gender roles, that should we give more Prabhupada talked about Varnashram quite a bit. Prabhupada talked about Sri Dharma. But then Prabhupada also engaged women in quite non-traditional roles. Now, he had single women going out alone or going out to distribute books, approaching unknown people, even unknown males, talking with them. This was completely untraditional for women to do. So Prabhupada engaged them. So I think I can't answer this question more specifically because it will require much more explanation. But it's a tension between whether bhakti is to be given more importance or varnashram is to be given more importance. And that has to be resolved. Okay. Thank you.
So, Prabhuji, you know, it's like, it's kind of an egoistic thing. And even some men, they are saying, oh, this is wrong, you know. Why can't ladies chant the Vedic mantras?
I really can't answer this right now. It's a big subject. Maybe in a future class, I can address this. I don't think I can give a conclusive position. But as I said, their both perspectives have have some merit to it. It's not just men trying to dominate women, or nor is it, it's not male chauvinism. And if women want to do certain things, it's not feminism. No, it's not. We cannot just give quick labels to things and demean the other side. So there are some valid points within that from the traditional perspective from each side. So in general, Prabhupada seemed to encourage everyone to perform, to practice bhakti. So whatever happened, Prabhupada encouraged everyone to serve. So that principle, how to reconcile that with the Vedic, with the tradition. So for example, I mean, during Prabhupada's time, there is no record, at least from what I have asked Prabhupada disciples. Like if somebody dies in your family, you shouldn't visit the temple for some number of days, 7 days, 8 days, 10 days. That's a general Indian traditional understanding. But there is no indication that Prabhupada implemented it during his times, when any of his disciples' relatives passed away or something like that. So now, should we implement that in our temples? Then we say, during Prabhupada's times, there is no mention of Pandav Nirjal Ekadashi. That was just another Ekadashi. But now it's a big thing. And devotees really do for a lot of austerity on that day. During Prabhupada's time, there is no mention of Bhishma Panchak. But Bhishma Panchak is celebrated in many different ways. So there are things which have been drawn from the Indian tradition. And now some of them, in one sense, assist in enhancing Krishna consciousness. Some of them may not enhance. So those who support it, they will say that, you know, this is a tradition supporting what is required for the growth of bhakti. Others will say that, no, this is just Indian Smartha Brahman thing being brought into ISKCON. So it is a complicated subject. That's why I don't want to get into it. I don't want to label either side right now. That one side is right and one side is wrong. But we need to encourage everyone to practice bhakti. And even if we are going to implement certain traditional rules, they should not be done in a way that anybody feels that they are being deprived or discriminated against. Now, how to do that? That is a challenge. Okay?
Thank you, Prabhu.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Very nice explanation. So, follow up to Shyama Gauri Mataji's question. So, as Mataji told, like it's mentioned, like we should not read Vedic hymns. And what happens is, in a few purports also, like in Bhagavatam, it's mentioned like women are low class. They are compared
Mataji,
to low class.
You know, I'm sorry. Let's not discuss about women right now. I will have a separate class, you know. Shyama Gauri Mataji, maybe you can also look at the purports, next few purports. If there is any theme which relates with women, I'll try to share.
So,
yes,
Prabhu. But when we see that chapter 23 in Krishna book, it's the Brahmana's wives, right? So, due to bhakti, they got elevated, right? So, so how can you say that to this, to the purpose which is told, Prabhuji? How can we relate that? I just want to know about it.
So there are two different things over there. Again, this is the tension between Varnashram and Bhakti. Nobody is saying that women can't be elevated. Nobody is saying that at all. What is being said is, can women perform particular rituals? So the Brahmana's Patnis came back, but it is described from what I read in Acharya's commentaries that they eventually, their husbands, they realized that they had done a wrong thing by, they've lamented, but then they performed a sacrifice together. And the yajna is more like a part of the Pancharatra Vidhi. It's not a Bhagavat Vidhi. So in that, their husbands were performing the yajna and they were assisting them. So the roles didn't change over there. So there is spiritual, with respect to devotional growth, there is no differentiation. And the Bhagavatam, in fact, repeatedly says that there may be women who may be actually more spiritually advanced than men. But with respect to the performance of particular rituals, whether women can perform the rituals which are performed by men, that is the question which is hotly debated sometimes.
Thank you, Prabhuji. Very wonderful class, Prabhuji, and wonderful explanations to the questions. Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Chaitanya Charan Prabhuji, Dandavat Pranam. Thank you for such a beautiful class, Prabhuji. And you addressed a very, very relevant situation that's actually all over the world right now, racial discrimination. But Prabhuji, do you have any more time, Prabhu? There are many raised hands.
Actually, I would love to discuss. The thing is that 7 o'clock, I have another class today. Do you want me to?
It's actually 7.
We can, in the next few days, I can take another class. Of course, it may disrupt your schedule. but we can continue this topic. I can push that till for 10 minutes and we can have a few questions if you want. We can take one or two questions more at least. But Shyamaguri Mata, you can decide how to take it forward. We can have quick question answers. One or two at least.
Yeah, Gaurangi Mataji.
Sure, okay, go.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
You know, I'm referring to your slide where you're saying that on one end of the spectrum, you know, there are those who claim spiritual equality, irrespective of material factors. And so if you could repeat for me, what is the problem with that? Because we do have, we are.
No, okay. So I give the example of the transgender, but you know, men and women are different. Say for example, men don't become pregnant. The procreative faculty, especially gestation, all that is done by females primarily. So we cannot eradicate biological differences or bodily differences in the name of spirituality. And I gave an example of how a man, suppose a transgender man competing in female sports can break havoc. So we cannot mandate absolute spiritual equality by eradicating gender differences. It will lead to chaos in society. So, you know, with transgender is becoming quite active, and there are cases of transgender men who claim to be women. They say that, you know, we are women, so we will go to women's bathrooms. And then they go to those bathrooms and then they molest women over there. So these are extreme examples of artificially claiming equality. So my point is that there are biological differences, and those differences, the same Bhagavatam which teaches that the male and female are souls who are, or both are souls, it also talks about the butterfly principle. And if men and women come together too closely and indiscriminately, that will lead to problems. So the point is, at a functional level, just like a Brahmana and a Vaishya are not the same. A Brahmana can do intellectual work and a Vaishya can do monetary work. That's just the way the body and mind are wired for them. So if we just say, because they're all souls, so let a Brahmana do a Vaishya work and a Vaishya do a Brahmana work. It's not going to work. So similarly, we cannot have absolute equality between males and females. That will actually lead to problems for everyone. I think that's again a subject.
I understand that, you know, materially we're not all equal, but spiritually we are, in the sense that we all have souls.
Of course. So I said that when I said absolute spiritual equality is imposed on society without considering material differences. At a functional level, we have to consider the differences. Now, how much to consider those differences and what way to consider, that may vary according to culture and context. But we cannot eradicate all differences.
Yeah, functionally, in a spiritual sense, we have to acknowledge different. I'm just having trouble.
No, functionally, even in a spiritual society, you know, just because we are a spiritual society, do we want indiscriminate mixing between the genders? Are all of us so spiritually advanced that there will be no problems resulting from that? No, there are some amount of distancing has to be there. Some amount of gender-specific rules have to be there. I've talked with devotees who come from the West and they come to Vrindavan. And if there is a lot of crowding and the males, females are mixing together, then even in the temples and near the temples, sometimes some unscrupulous males may molest the females, touch them inappropriately. So horrible things. So some amount of differentiation at a functional level may be required even in spiritual circles.
Okay, so that's the point of that end of this pendulum.
Yeah, so eradicating all differences at a functional level also can lead to big problems.
Okay. All right, Prabhu.
So, okay, one last question. Suresh Vasham Prabhu, you want to take the question or one? We'll continue after that then.
Thank you very much, Prabhu. Dandavat Pranam. So, Prabhuji, very nice class, Prabhu. Very treat, philosophical treat for the mind. And so, Prabhuji, one question I had, the Shatbhuj Murti form that is given in the purport, right? Prabhu, can you elaborate on that, Prabhu? Please, and where did Mahaprabhu show? I couldn't recollect, Prabhu. Where did Mahaprabhu show that Shatbhuj Murti form? The purport, last paragraph.
I'll have to check this.
Okay.
Did he show it to Sarvam Bhattacharya? I think he showed it to, it's mentioned. I'll find it out and maybe I'll message you separately.
Yeah.
Yes, Prabhuji.
Okay. So,
thank you very much.
Sarvam Bhattacharya only. Let the Mataji say only. Anything so to Sarvam Bhattacharya. Okay. So, okay. Thank you very much. Gantraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki.
Ki chai.
The Prabhupada ki.
Chai. Thank you.